president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh,
the suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
Good evening. It's November 27th, 1978. That was Dianne Feinstein, president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, shortly after the shooting. Tonight, much of the newscast will be devoted to reports on the tragic shootings of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Milk. In other news, Japanese Prime Minister Takeo Fukuda suffered a stunning defeat in his party's primary elections, all but putting an end to his two-year term. China's Premier Deng Xiaoping appears to be on the verge of replacing party chairman Hua Guofeng as China's premier. The United States Supreme Court today refused to hear an appeal by New York Times reporter Myron Farber on his 35-day jail sentence for refusing to hand over his personal notes to a New Jersey judge. But before we look at these stories, here's Lily Franklin with the report on today's assassinations in San Francisco.
At 11 a.m. this morning, San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and City Supervisor Harvey Milk were shot and killed in their City Hall offices. Board of Supervisors Dianne Feinstein, who now becomes acting mayor of San Francisco, made the announcement to a stunned group in City Hall. Dan White has turned himself into police and is now under 24-hour suicide surveillance. The motive for the killings was apparently a personal vendetta. This morning, Moscone was to hold a press conference to announce the appointment of a supervisor to fill White's position. White had resigned from the board earlier this month, claiming that the salary was inadequate for him to support his family. Later, he changed his mind and asked to have the position back. Though Moscone had the option to reappoint White, a conservative voice on the board, the mayor had expressed interest in several other candidates. The motives for the Moscone shooting are clear. The death of Supervisor Harvey Milk is more of a mystery. Milk was a political opponent of White's, an outspoken liberal, and the first avowed gay candidate on the board. Harvey Milk was not in favor of reappointing White to his position. Both White and Milk were elected at the same time during district elections last year. While San Francisco officials are in a state of shock, thousands of quiet mourners have brought flowers for Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk to the steps of City Hall. For Pacifica in Berkeley, this is Lily Franklin. We'll have more details on the background of Dan White coming up shortly in the news. But first, here is a statement by Mel Wax, the mayor's press secretary, in City Hall shortly after the shooting.
There was a meeting this morning, Dan White, former supervisor, came in to see the mayor. He was admitted in to see him in the mayor's office. The two of them were in there alone in the back room. We heard shots. Supervisor White, we were unaware that the shots were coming from the back room, and we were unaware that there were shots at the time. Supervisor White walked out the back door. I'm informed some people have seen him. We went into the mayor, and the mayor was dead.
That was followed by a statement by Dianne Feinstein, who in her capacity as acting mayor of San Francisco, proclaimed a state of mourning in the city.
Today, San Francisco has suffered a double tragedy of incredible proportions in the loss of our beloved mayor, George Moscone, and Harvey Milk. As president of the Board of Supervisors, I'll recess the 2 p.m. meeting of the board pending further call of the chair. As acting mayor, I order an immediate state of mourning in our city for the loss of our mayor and our supervisors. The city and county of San Francisco must and will pull together at this time.
The chronology of events, as far as we know, was this. Shortly after 11 a.m., former Supervisor Dan White met with Moscone in his office in City Hall. Allegedly, there was a short argument between the two. Then White pulled a gun and shot Moscone. He then walked to his office, where he allegedly shot and killed Harvey Milk. It is still being disputed as to whether he summoned Milk to his office or found him there. San Francisco City Hall has a special metal detector near the front door, but supervisors often come in through the basement using a special key. This was the route that White took, both in and out of the building, so his gun was not detected. After the shooting, he left in his car, somehow getting through a police cordon, and the police issued alerts for the car. White, however, soon turned himself in. Daniel James White, booked for investigation of murder, in the slangs of Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk, is himself a former supervisor, a former firefighter, and a former policeman. He's also a former military paratrooper who served in Vietnam. He is 32 years old, married, and has a 5-month-old son. He was captain of his high school football and baseball teams, and adjectives like meritorious, excellent, and unblemished followed his career until November 10th of 1977, when he abruptly resigned his seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Rob Waters of the People's Media Collective researched the events which followed White's resignation, and here's his report.
Today's tragedy in San Francisco's City Hall was the climax of a series of events which actually began on November 10th with the unexpected announcement by then-Supervisor Dan White that he was resigning his seat with the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. At the time, White said that he was not making enough money from his $9,600-a-year supervisor salary and therefore had to devote time to his fast food stand at Pier 39 to bring in extra income. The people of San Francisco need full-time legislators, and the supervisors should have a full-time salary, White said. At the time, Moscone said he was stunned and had high praises for White. Then, 6 days later, White said he had changed his mind and wanted his seat back. Moscone agreed to return the letter of resignation, but the city attorney's office stepped in, saying there were legal problems with revoking resignations and that they would have to study the question. White announced that he wanted his seat back at a press conference attended by representatives of the Police Officers Association and real estate firms, whose interests White had clearly served while in office. It's unclear exactly what caused White to attempt to get his seat back. He said that his family had offered him financial assistance and that he had been flooded with calls from supporters in his home district. But there was also speculation by some community activists that real estate interests, not wanting to lose a vote on the board, might have attempted to persuade White to stay on. Meanwhile, opponents of White from his district, District 8, began marshaling their forces against his reinstatement. They held a rally in Visitation Valley on the 16th, at which White himself showed up and attempted to interrupt the activities. The rally organizers called White a dictator and said they wanted Moscone to appoint someone else. Last Tuesday, Mayor Moscone stepped back from his earlier pledge to reappoint White, saying that he had received many complaints against White by residents of his district. Moscone said that he would announce his decision on the matter this morning. As White's chances for reappointment seemed to grow slimmer, White apparently became more desperate, and last Friday he wrote a letter to City Attorney George Agnost claiming that his purported resignation letter to Moscone was not legally effective because it was submitted to Moscone rather than the clerk of the Board of Supervisors. Moscone dismissed White's letter as an innovative legal approach, but not accurate. Finally, Mayor Moscone called a press conference for this morning at 11:30, at which he was to announce his appointment to fill White's seat. That press conference never happened. In San Francisco, this is Rob Waters for the People's Media Collective.
Last night, KCBS radio reporter Barbara Taylor called White for his reaction to reports that Moscone had told associates he planned to name Don Herenzi as White's replacement. Taylor said that White seemed taken aback, that he hadn't heard from the mayor, and then he hung up on her. She also said that he seemed quite desperate. KPFA has begun investigating what Rob Waters termed community activist charges of realty interest involvement in White's decision to try to retain his supervisorial seat. Two realtors represented at White's press conference were Pyramid Realty and Caldwell Banker. We asked Caldwell Banker Vice President Ray Brown to explain his connection to White and his presence at White's press conference.
Well, I was there. I was there more, I think, for the Board of Realtors than Caldwell Banker. And, you know, my reaction to today is probably identical to every
was the Board of Realtors interested in Dan White staying on the Board of Supervisors?
Well, I can't speak for the whole Board of Realtors. I came to know Dan and respect him, and you know, I was interested as a person, Ray Brown. Not Coldwell Banker, not Board of Realtors, it's just Ray Brown. I felt he was a good person.
Uh-huh, because originally you said that you had been there for the Board of Realtors. That's why I asked you.
Well, yeah, we had worked together in the past in the sense that, and what I'm telling you, I'm not telling you really as a quote as much as a background on Dan as a whole. It's just Dan being a supervisor, we all of us wanted to know the supervisors as much as we could, because every now and then you're going to have legislation which affects real estate.
So he didn't seem to consult with anybody with any of the decisions that he's made recently.
I wasn't asked when he resigned. I wasn't asked when he withdrew his resignation. I just was sort of on the periphery of the people who were affected by it.
Okay.
But I just really find it hard to believe that Dan has done this, because it's so out of character.
That was Realty Vice President Ray Brown commenting on his relationship to Dan White. Meanwhile, the reactions to the deaths of Moscone and Harvey Milk have left people in a state of shock and despair. Right after the shootings, many were primarily stunned by the loss of a close personal friend. Here's Assemblymember Willie Brown.
I lost a friend. And I've been crying and I've been moping for the last hour. And I lost my closest personal political friend. I lost a family friend, and Gina lost a husband, and one of my ex-employees lost a father, so there's no way, all in one, and that's a hard combination. There are so few decent people in politics, and George Moscone was one of the few individuals in the political arena who responds as a human being rather than as a politician.
Mervyn Dimely was so badly shaken by the news that when the first calls came in from the press, he broke up into tears and was unable to talk. Dimely was a very close friend of Moscone's, as well as a strong political ally of Harvey Milk's. Eventually, he regained enough composure to say this about the shootings.
George's death is a loss not only to San Francisco, but the entire nation. It's a personal loss to me. He and I were going to have breakfast on Friday. I think what his death points out is a need for more political tolerance and an understanding of how the political process is. And it's obvious now that politics is a national hazard. It's no fun anymore.
What about Mr. Milk? You worked very closely with him on the Third World Coalition.
Well, Harvey Milk was a very courageous man, and he taught me to be tolerant about gays and to be tolerant about society as a whole, and his loss too is a tremendous tragedy to all of the people who are seeking for a more tolerant society.
But the tragic death of these two San Francisco officials represented a tremendous public loss as well. Here's Helen Miskevich with a report on Moscone's career.
George Moscone became the mayor of San Francisco just 2 years ago. He won election in a close race with San Francisco supervisor John Barbagallotta in November of 1976. Moscone had entered politics in 1963 as the second youngest person ever elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors at the age of 33. 3 years later, he defeated supervisor Leo McCarthy, now Speaker of the State Assembly, in a race for state senator. As state senator, Moscone gained renown for sponsoring progressive legislation, including bills on abortion and marijuana reform. After being elected mayor of San Francisco, Moscone avoided many of the trappings of that office, including a personal bodyguard. But he did have metal detectors installed at public entrances to City Hall after a man with a gun was arrested in his office in April of 1977. Moscone was an astute politician and a generally friendly, likable man, but his administration was not without its shadows. Recently, he was charged with accepting a check for $10,000 from Howard Hughes' estate to further the interests of Hughes Air West Airlines, and Moscone was severely criticized for his appointment last year of Reverend Jim Jones as head of the city's housing authority. The flack resulted in Jones declining the post. Shortly afterwards, Jones left for Guyana. Moscone, however, remained convinced that Jones was a decent, caring person and that the People's Temple was a worthy establishment. establishment. When news of the deaths of Congressmember Leo Ryan and others in Guyana reached Moscone, here's what he had to say.
He was a man of peacefulness, of quietude, a person who discouraged the use of violence, particularly among poor and frustrated people who wanted to help them to rehabilitate themselves, to keep away from drugs and alcohol, and he performed as a member of the Housing Authority in that fashion.
In retrospect, it seems that as mayor, Moscone never really emerged from the shadow of his predecessor, Joe Alioto. During his 2 years in office, he was frustrated by a board of supervisors at least as powerful as the mayor's office, if not more so. Nonetheless, George Moscone was faring well, although he did face a serious challenge from Supervisor Quentin Kopp. Whether or not he would have survived such a challenge, Moscone did have a bright political future, one that ended today with three gunshots. For Pacifica, I'm Helen Mickiewicz.
Harvey Milk was the first avowed gay supervisor to serve in the city, and predictably the reaction in the gay community to his death is grief-stricken and outraged. Here's Philip Muldari with a report.
Harvey, do you have a few words for KPFA?
Yes. Come on out! Join us! Bring a friend!
That was Harvey Milk as he led last spring's 7th annual Gay Freedom Day parade in San Francisco. Harvey's death today has left the city shocked and horrified at the loss of a dear friend, a neighbor, and a courageous leader of the people of San Francisco. Harvey was the first openly gay elected official in California. He first gained public recognition in the early 70s as an outspoken defender of gays who frequently confronted police harassment and official disdain. In three unsuccessful races for public office, he gradually built a coalition of gays, minorities, and women, which spoke directly to the issues of human rights for all disadvantaged people. He fought the Democratic Party machine and San Francisco's gay establishment to finally win election to the Board of Supervisors in November of 1977. While working on the board this past year, Harvey became a national spokesperson in the fight against Senator John Briggs' anti-gay school teachers initiative, Proposition 6. Today I spoke with Tom Amiano of San Francisco's Gay Teachers Coalition.
The best debate I ever saw him do was at the Jewish temple in, I guess it was Oakland. He was really magnificent then. Harvey, because he was a Jew and because he was a fag, and here was Briggs, you know, representing all the antithesis to that, you know, a fundamentalist, a homophobe, and Harvey was brilliant, and that star that Harvey planted in the sky that night is going to shine for a long time.
While many in the gay community tonight seem to be convinced that Harvey was murdered because he was gay, the rest of us can only wonder where to go from here. I spoke with a neighbor of Harvey's this afternoon on Castro Street.
It doesn't have to be a loss. And the energy that we saw coming from Harvey every day is an energy that every one of us has within us. And what we have to do is summon it and use it and apply it every day. And then there is no loss.
For Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, this is Philip Muldery reporting.
There will be a march tonight to commemorate the deaths of Moscone and Harvey Milk that will start at about 8:30 on Castro and 15th Streets at the intersection there. And the mourners will make their way to City Hall, and they are advised to bring candles. So that's tonight at 8:30 at 15th in Castro. And we do have a report which is not officially confirmed, but nonetheless it seems like it is probably true that Moscone's body will lie in state, apparently beginning tomorrow, in the City Hall Rotunda. There will be a memorial service at noon on Wednesday the 29th, and a rosary service will be said at St. Mary's at 5 p.m. on Wednesday evening. And the word is that the funeral will be on Thursday the 30th, and that is for Mayor Moscone. Harvey's funeral has not yet been completed, because we did get a word from Carol Ruth Silver that he wanted a non-denominational type of funeral. But we had a reporter at a press conference this afternoon who found something out about that, so we will have that information on Behind the News tonight beginning at 6:45. And we'll be back with more news in a minute. Thank you.
Meanwhile, in news about the Jonestown suicides and murders, whatever you want to call it, the State Department said in Washington today that it expects survivors of the People's Temple suicide murders to return home from Georgetown tomorrow. However, the decision as to which Jonestown survivors will return to the U.S. rests with the Guyanese, who have given no sign when such a return will be permitted. Meanwhile, up to 30 FBI agents waited at the Charleston Air Force Base today to question the returnees. U.S. Attorney Thomas Lydon is prepared to file charges against any of the members who might have had a part in killing Congressman Leo Ryan. The U.S. attorney said that Ryan's murder can be prosecuted only by federal authorities. You may remember about that purported suicide note that was found on Reverend Jim Jones's body. Well, that was not a suicide note. Apparently, it was a note written by one of Jones' members of the People's Temple. The note read, "Dad, I see no way out. I agree with your decision. I fear only that without you, the world may not make it to communism. For my part, I am more than tired of this wretched, merciless planet and the hell it holds for so many masses of beautiful people. Thank you for the only life I have known." Apparently, the dad in this note was Jim Jones. He liked to be referred to that way. The FBI did not release the name of the person who signed that note. While the situation in Jonestown draws to a close, another movement is forming here in the United States. A 15-member body of Baptist ministers held a press conference in San Francisco to announce their support of those survivors of the Jonestown tragedy, as well as providing assistance for the dead. Here's Wendell Harper with the details.
A conference of Baptist ministers are conducting a fundraising drive to provide financial assistance for relatives of those who died in Guyana, as well as the survivors of the Jonestown tragedy. According to Baptist ministers spokesperson Reverend Amos Brown, such financial assistance will be provided for those who need it most. Burial and transportation assistance will be provided for some of the Jonestown dead and the survivors, according to Brown. Brown said, while the 15-member Baptist Ministers Conference deplores the tragedy which occurred in Guyana, they are not pointing a finger at anyone.
We're not speaking of any categorical castigation of Reverend Jones. What has happened has happened. But what we are saying is that we are concerned about and we deplore any leadership on the part of the Christian church that does not deal in a compassionate, humane way to alleviate the plight of the poor or other people, regardless of their situation, to make things better. And we must say also that Jesus said, "I came that they might have life and that they may have it more abundantly." Now, while the plight of the poor was difficult, yet we feel that the end result should have been supporting a quest for life and not death.
More than the People's Temple, says Brown, the entire country is indirectly responsible for what happened in Jonestown. Brown said, however, that the minister's group is not interested in investigating the situation in Guyana. The thrust, according to Brown, should be to put the tragedy behind us and try moving ahead. KPFA asked Brown if he thought the role of the People's Temple had been misunderstood by the press in the U.S.
I would say maybe there was not any understanding. There was no communication. We must see that in addition to meeting people's physical needs, you must speak to their spiritual needs. And the spiritual need is to feel that regardless to your circumstance, whether you have money or you don't have money, you still have the will to live and to know that there is life in spite of circumstances of life.
The minister's group says all churches they represent are collecting money for assistance to those involved in the Guyana tragedy. The group is also looking into the possibility of having the bodies transferred to the West Coast. This is Wendell Harper for KPFA News.
Richard Nixon graced the world today with some profound insights into the nature of American society. He waited until he was out of the country, in Paris, in fact, where perhaps he is listened to a little more carefully than he is here. He said that the events in Jonestown should not be seen as a reflection on American society and on the society of the West. He said that Jones was very insane. What he offered Nixon said was wrong, but his followers, in Nixon's words, were searching for something, and I think that throughout the world today, people have a need to believe in something to have faith.
And you're listening to the KPFA Evening News with Louis Freeburg and Lily Franklin. Japan's Prime Minister, Takeo Fukuda, essentially ended his two-year term as Prime Minister today. In a surprising upset, Fukuda lost the ruling Liberal Democratic Party's primary elections to a former foreign minister and current party secretary, Masayoshi Ohira. There is not much difference between the two candidates on major issues, except that Ohira has a more moderate position on the critical issue of nuclear energy and the rearmament of Japan. Brenda Wilson has the details.
Some early predictions indicated that Ohira was gaining in support. The Japanese embassy here predicted it would be a close election, but no one, including Fukuda himself, thought he would lose by such a wide margin. This is the first time the ruling Liberal Democratic Party has had open elections to choose its leadership. The party will abide by the will of its membership when Parliament elects its prime minister this Friday. For the sake of party unity, Fukuda says he'll step down and give Ohira an unopposed battle for the party presidency. The president automatically becomes prime minister. Actually, a broad coalition of political forces, the power battle is played out among different factions of the Liberal Democratic Party. And Ohira's victory might mean more immediate power for former Prime Minister Tanaka, who was forced to resign in disgrace after he was charged with accepting bribes from the Lockheed Corporation.
But Mr. Tanaka seems no ambitious to come back again as a prime minister or the leader of the LDP.
Washington correspondent for a Tokyo newspaper, Mr. Ohei.
He is still having hope to be an influential person as an old boy. He's not so old, but I mean a political sense. He'd like to keep his influential power among LDP parties. And Ohira's victory could be a one step for Mr. Tanaka.
The still powerful Tanaka faction endorsed Ohira just 1 week before the primaries. And Prime Minister Fukuda criticized that action, charging the faction with buying support for Ohira. Japanese experts here see little difference between Ohira and Prime Minister Fukuda. Both support a greater defense budget. Fukuda and Ohira both favor greater friendship between China and Japan. Fukuda just signed a friendship treaty with Peking, and as foreign minister, Ohira negotiated diplomatic relations in 1972. And no major shift is expected in U.S.-Japan relations. Ohira is expected to carry on Fukuda's commitment to a balance of trade more favorable to the U.S. This upset is seen as just a coup within the ruling party, although the Socialist and Communist parties have won local elections over the past 15 years, they've been unable to win victory on a national level. For Pacifica in Washington, this is Patricia Naimond.
Amnesty International today accused China of systematically repressing political dissent through social censure, imprisonment, mental torture, and execution. Amnesty International issued its first major report on China and quoted official Chinese documents indicating that the number punished for political dissent has run into the millions since 1949. The report urges, in its words, a repeal of all laws prescribing administrative or criminal punishment for the nonviolent expression of belief. The report says laws are loosely worded and have been interpreted broadly, permitting large-scale imprisonment on political grounds. Meanwhile, in China itself, a week after the first wall posters appeared in Peking criticizing Chairman Mao, a flurry of new posters have appeared as China appears to be in the midst of new upheavals in support of its modernization program, led by the once discredited Deng Xiaoping. Here's Robert Manning with the story.
Several thousand Chinese demonstrated in downtown Peking today as more posters continue to appear on Peking's main streets in what analysts are saying is the biggest outpouring of popular criticism since the late Mao Zedong launched the 100 Flowers campaign 21 years ago. Observers in Peking report an unprecedented new mood of openness and curiosity. Foreigners are being stopped in the streets and asked about human rights, democracy, and life in the United States. Perhaps most amazingly, posters have appeared praising the United States and expressing open envy of Taiwan. One poster said, "The U.S. is the most developed country in the world, and it has developed because it has no idols nor superstitions." Another poster asks, "Why can't our national economy catch up with that of Taiwan?" The meaning of the new poster campaign is not yet clear, but it appears obvious that the outpouring of popular protest is at least tacitly supported by the government. Some of the posters have called for Deng Xiaoping to replace Hua Guofeng as premier, and there is speculation that Deng may be promoted. However, Deng himself told a visiting American journalist today that he had been offered the premiership but rejected it because of his age. Deng Xiaoping is in his 70s, and he says he would rather focus his energies on China's rapid modernization program. Mao Zedong himself has been one of the main targets of the poster campaign. Mao has been criticized for being mistaken in his old age. One poster said that Mao was 70% right and 30% wrong. But Deng Xiaoping said today that the criticisms of Mao have gone a bit overboard. Deng defended Mao, saying that every Chinese knows that without Chairman Mao, there would be no new China. The Chinese Communist Party Central Committee met over the weekend, and observers expect changes to be announced in top Chinese leadership. For Pacifica, this is Robert Manning.
President Carter will meet with Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Khalil in Washington tomorrow in the latest attempt to break the deadlock in the peace treaty talks between Israel and Egypt. Those talks have been going on for 7 weeks, and the major stumbling block is still the issue of Palestinian self-rule. Egypt wants a specific timetable on the Palestinian question included in the treaty, but Israel has refused to be tied down to any timetable. A U.S. proposal is on the table that would link an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty to elections on the West Bank of the Jordan River and the Gaza Strip by the end of 1979. This proposal has received favorable treatment by Egyptian press, and it may be being written in the draft treaty that President Sadat is working on at the moment. Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin says he will only come to Washington to sign a peace treaty, not to reopen negotiations.
President Carter, declaring that no aspect of government will be sacred, warned some of the nation's top urban leaders today that the next federal budget will be very, very tight and that they will have to exercise restraint to help fight inflation. Carter was speaking to the board of directors of the National League of Cities and told them that military spending will be scrutinized as carefully as domestic programs. This is something new coming from Carter. He did not indicate which parts of the military budget would be cut. White House officials, of course, had previously said that military spending would not be cut. Carter did say that the domestic budget would be cut without starving useful programs. The United States Supreme Court today made what may become a landmark non-ruling today by refusing to hear an appeal by New York Times reporter Myron Farber. Farber was appealing his sentencing to 35 days in jail for refusing to hand over his personal notes to a New Jersey judge. Farber was released from jail when the trial of Dr. Mario Yaskolovich ended, so that today's Supreme Court ruling means that the issue will never be settled whether Farber was, in fact, protected by the First Amendment in his refusal to hand over his notes. Farber said today, "I always looked at the Supreme Court as the court of last resort. It makes you think." And Times publisher Arthur Oakes Salzberger complained that the court must someday address itself to the critical issues raised by Farber's case. 25 states, including New Jersey, have so-called shield laws, which protect reporters from having to reveal their sources. Salzberger said it would seem simple logic that before a reporter goes to jail and the Times pays fines, that there be a hearing to determine whether the shield law is real or made of paper mache. Salzberger will have to wait until the Supreme Court is ready to handle this sensitive issue.
Henry Jackson led a group of U.S. senators in warning NATO representatives that the proposed new SALT treaty, SALT II, could erode America's ability to defend Europe. Jackson told the military committee at the NATO assembly that Moscow's high arms bill suggests that Soviet leaders want a broad military advantage over Western countries. Jackson told a news conference later, if they want to throw away their opportunity to have the protection of a strong American umbrella, which has been the main deterrent, that is, of course, up to them.
If you've been following the news accounts of the House Subcommittee's investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., then you may know that the committee is purportedly edging its way to a conspiracy allegation, one that argues that James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King for money, perhaps with his family's help. Today, the committee virtually admitted that that's where its investigation is headed. Tonight on Behind the News, Marty Goldenson will be filing an in-depth report on the assassination hearings. That's tonight at 6:45, so please tune in then. And finally, here in Berkeley, 38 students who sat in last June in Sproul Hall to protest university investments in South Africa have been found guilty by a Berkeley Committee on Student Conduct. The committee recommended to Chancellor Bowker that the students be given nothing worse than an official reprimand, which would appear in the students' files. Bowker is not bound by the committee's findings, and it remains to be seen if he will concur. Bowker has said previously that he thinks the students should be punished, and that he thought the municipal courts would let them off too easy. Thus, some of the students fear that Bowker will take stronger action than the committee recommends. So the students have a week or two to wait for Bowker's final choice, and then face criminal proceedings in mid-December. And that just about wraps it up for the evening news. The weather today, fair through tomorrow, through Wednesday actually, except for local dense fog and low clouds late tonight and in the morning. In the San Joaquin Valley, it will also be fair through Wednesday, with variable fog locally, dense at night and in the mornings. Helen Miscavige, Bob Stern, Eve Sternberg, Alan Cohen, and I'm sure a lot of other people helped put together the newscast tonight on this tragic day in San Francisco. Lily has something to say, I understand.
We've just gotten a message that the march that we mentioned earlier to commemorate Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk, there will be a memorial march tonight, and that is leaving, I believe, at 8:30 from 18th and Castro Streets. And people are urged to bring candles with them, and they'll be going from 18th and Castro down to City Hall.
Thanks for listening. With Lily Franklin, I'm Louis Friedberg. Good evening.
You're listening to KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno, listener-sponsored radio for Northern and Central California.